Sick Boy Podcast is a health and comedy show about what it's like to be sick. Wait, is that right? How can illness be funny?
You'd be surprised.
Okay. Sick Boy is hosted by
me, Brian Stever.
And me, Taylor McGilvery.
And myself, Jeremy Saunders.
Come on in and join us to melt your heart, learn something fascinating, and bust a belly laugh. Trust us, you'll be glad you did.
You can find Sick Boy on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your pods.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Q. So the Canadian Screen Awards are coming up. If you don't know, that's like the Canadian Emmys and Oscars into one. And one award presentation is worth talking about for sure. It's the Changemaker Award. The Changemaker Award is given out annually to someone who over their career has used their voice and platform to call out systemic racism and discrimination. This year, the award is going to Tanya Williams. Tanya is an actor from Toronto. If you watch the soaps or if you put them on while you were homesick from school, you might recognize Tanya as playing Dr. Olivia Barber Winters on the big hit soap opera, The Young and the Restless. You're listening to that theme right now. Brings back being at my Nanny Hayward's house. And that playing in the background. Also called Nadia's theme. Tanya Williams was one of the first black actors on a soap opera, in particular playing a doctor when, as she'll tell you, she felt the other roles that were offered to her were more harmful and more stereotypical. Tanya then started the Real World Film Festival to advocate and lift up other racialized actors and filmmakers. But what you learn from this conversation is, even though she's an actor that's broken so much ground, been part of so many firsts, that wasn't the plan. She just set out to do work that she was proud of and, as you'll hear, make her parents proud. Milk commercials, the polka dot door, how playing a doctor on TV leads to a lot of oversharing to breaking boundaries. Tanya Williams joined me to look back. Here's our conversation. How are you? Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
Congratulations on the award.
I am thrilled. I really am. It's fantastic.
It must have been, it must have been a meaningful award to get.
It's a really meaningful award because, I mean, I've been an actor since I was 17 years old. I'm 65 now. And for me, I love the idea of receiving an award for the work I've done that's not about my acting, you know, that's really about what happens with all of us as we get older. It's giving back and making sure the next generation has the opportunities that maybe we didn't have. And so to be recognized for that is just so sweet. For me.
You know, I watched, getting ready for this interview, I watched a milk ad you did where you had a milk mustache.
Yes. I think that was the second or third commercial I ever did. I was about 18 years old in that. And I don't know if this has happened to you, Tom, but it's like, you know, you go and do a job that you think, oh, this is a tiny little gig that nobody will see. And then it blows up into this huge national thing. I think it was the first really massive thing that people recognized me for, because they did billboards and the commercials, I think they ended up doing like five or six national spots out of it. And they ran for like 5 years and it was just such a huge campaign.
So you were walking down the street and people were shouting out milk to you?
Oh my God. Well, first of all, let's take you back to around 1977, 78. There were almost no people of color on camera.
Right, right.
So people weren't just shouting milk. They're like, oh my God, it's you. Like, seeing someone of color, when I say color, it wasn't just black people that were embracing me. Everybody was, because there was no one else that they were seeing on this scale. So I literally was, I was an overnight recognizable success for everyone of color across Canada, really instantly.
Well, then things move on. I want to play something for you. Just take a listen to this.
Humpty's a robin redbreast,
and Dumpty's a chickadee.
They spread out their wings and go flying,
oh, flying
from me to you.
Tanya Williams, do you know what that is?
Oh, what? Let me guess. It's Polka Dot Door, but you know what? You can tell. You know, I just have to admit that high quality of singing That is actually me, Tom. they did not bring in a professional. I'm not dubbing there that is my quality singing.
That show was so popular, and it really meant to so many people, particularly in Ontario, but all over Canada. What did that show mean to you?
It meant a lot to me because, once again, and I think you'll hear this from a lot of, especially older people of color, where you're like the first. Yeah. I was often the first Black person very young kids saw. And I mean white kids also. So I was, once again, a little tiny polka dot door celebrity where I would go to the malls and you would meet all these little kids who had not actually met any people of color before. And it was great to be that that positive influence, that positive image that they saw as 2 and 3 and 4 year olds, that they sort of, you know, I was secretly in their minds shaping what their image was of what Black people were. And I was very proud of that work, actually. And I think Polka Dot Door stands up even today. It's a great show.
Is there someone in your childhood or in your family? Like, I guess what I'm hearing here is I want people to understand just how groundbreaking this was. We're going to talk about Young and the Restless in a minute, and it was there as well. But it's not without a certain level of courage. It's easy now that you win an award to say, oh, you had courage and bravery to get through all this. But people don't actually know what that means and what you have to go through and the amount of no's you have to get and the amount of disrespectful comments you have to get. Is there someone in your childhood or your family, is there something about the way you were brought up that made you want to get this firstness?
Yeah, I wished I didn't have to be the firstness, to tell you the truth. That wasn't sort of in my mind. But my father, a Black man, became a lawyer in the late 40s, early 50s, when that was unheard of.
Yeah.
So I already came from my mother, who left home, you know, when she was 21 years old in Jamaica, to cross the ocean by herself as a young woman to England, a place she'd never been, to study nursing and become a registered nurse. So I come from those parents who really instilled in me that the world outside was not going to be opening the doors for me.
Yeah.
That I needed to set my own intention, and then I needed to walk in that direction. And then I needed to basically ignore whatever people were thinking or saying was an impossible task or challenges. I mean, I actually think all of us have challenges, no matter who we are.
Yeah.
And the idea is not to lean into those and feel that those are the reasons to not move forward. You're going to meet people who are going to try and stop you. But I really feel like, I don't know, I have an ability to ignore them. I don't know what that is. It's not even like I'm purposely ignoring them. You know, if they kind of go, you know, there's a cliff over there you could fall over, I kind of go, yeah, you're right, there's a cliff. And then I just keep moving in that direction. But certainly when I think back of me as a little kid watching TV, there was nothing there. There was no part of me that went, oh, one day I want to be on the screen and I want to do this. I don't remember ever thinking those things. And the saddest part is I don't remember not noticing when there was no Black people there.
Right.
It just seemed normal to me that everybody was white on the screen. I remember, I think I was around 8 or 9 or 10 years old, where I think I was watching like Tarzan or some show like that. And I think it was the first Black person I saw. And I remember feeling embarrassed because it was like a half naked tribal person carrying a spear, and you know, like it did not look like my life around me. And I felt uncomfortable thinking that I was going to go to school and be teased about those images, which I was. So those were my early sort of memories of what that looked like. And it can affect you. I really feel I would have been a different person if I didn't have the parents I had, if I didn't have the opportunity to see them and their friends be very accomplished people who looked like I did. I think it would be very hard if the only memory or the only images I had were the ones I was looking on the screen.
What's interesting about that is after Polka Dot Door, when you move out to L.A., I've heard you talk a little bit about this, and I was hoping you might talk about it if you feel comfortable doing so, that the role, even back then, I mean, speaking of what you were talking about, watching Tarzan and all that, the roles you were being asked to audition for were demeaning?
Stereotypical, negative stereotypes. But I don't have to say that I went all the way to LA for that. That was being presented to me in Canada.
Really?
A lot of the roles in Canada when I was starting out, before I moved to the States, they were about, they needed a prostitute. You know, they needed someone that looked like a young mom from the projects who already had five kids. You know, someone who, so there was a lot of me turning down that stuff because a part of me wanted to make my parents proud. They had fought so much for where they were. I'm an only child. I can't imagine both my parents looking at the one child they brought into the world, perpetuating the stereotypes that they'd fought against their whole life. So yes, but when I got to Los Angeles, absolutely, I didn't speak the way they wanted Black people to speak. And then what was funny was going back to Canada, and because so many of the American productions were now shooting in Canada, and I would go to a casting there and they would say, can you speak more Black? I'm like, I am speaking more Black because I am Black. So that is, but you know what they wanted, there's a stereotype to how they think Black people should speak. And they wanted to keep perpetuating that through all these characters, which was just annoying to me. And which is why, even though when my agents did not want me to do a soap opera, if you've spent any time in Los Angeles and you've worked down here, soaps is not where your agents are trying to get you. But the character was one that it meant I could feel something inside of me that this is how I wanted to present.
But wasn't the character on The Young and the Restless created for you? Like there wasn't, you were originally up for another role?
It was, because I love this, Tom. You actually read up on me.
Once a year, every year, you know, Tanya.
I love this. So I'd had the long conversation with my agents in LA about the things I didn't want to do. So, of course, right away, they go, we know all the things you don't want to do. So we'd like you to go audition for this illiterate girl, homeless girl on the street. I'm like, did you not hear anything I said? And they went, you know what? We know you don't want this role, but just it's always good to go in and meet the casting people and meet the people so that they can start to get to know you. But yeah, I went into audition for a character called Drusilla, which was the last kind of character I would ever want to do. And no disregard to Victoria Rowell, who did an amazing job in that role, but it was not the kind of role I wanted to do. So of course I go in and I read the role pretty much like how I'm talking to you, Tom. So I know they do not want her to sound anything like me right now. And I say, thank you very much. And I leave.
Right.
And then about a week later, my agents call me back and they go, you have a callback for The Young and the Restless, which I was like, there is no way in God's green earth they could be calling me back for this role. And they went, no, it's actually a different role. It's called, her character's called Olivia, and she's this doctor. And she's, it was like everything that I would have written on a card, a wish card for a character. And I went, oh, that sounds really good. So I thought something was weird when I went back to the audition and I was the only one in the waiting room. Because you know, normally you go and you see a bunch of people that look just like you waiting to go into the audition. But right. I was the only one waiting in the waiting room. And then I went in and did the audition. And then as I'm leaving the studio, the casting director ran out right after me in the parking lot and said, can you come back and go up to wardrobe? So it was like that. I was like, what? She goes, yes, you've gotten the role. And I was just like, I had no idea what was happening. It was so surreal. But years later, when I was talking to Bill Bell at a function that was happening, he said, I don't think I ever told you how you got the role of Olivia. And he goes, we actually didn't have that role at all. And you came in the room and there was something about you and something about just everything about you that made me at that moment decide this other character, Drusilla, needed a balance and it needed to be a different kind of Black person that you don't always see on TV.
Is it true what you said?
Oh, that you brought such joy to your daddy and me? Of course it's true, Olivia. Oh, you're the most special baby a mother could ever hope to have.
That's not what I'm talking about, Mama. I'm talking about Drusilla.
Drusilla was trouble from the beginning. She was always misbehaving, never minding.
Yes, I always thought the same thing too, Mama, but not anymore. She may have lived in the same house. She may have had the same parents, but she certainly did not feel the same love.
I mean, and it wasn't just actors. I mean, I heard you talk about how, you know, when you joined The Young and the Restless, the soap opera world was, it wasn't just white actors. It was full of, it was, you know, all white crew members, you know, all white writers, you know.
Hair and makeup. It was everything. I mean, there's a lot of talk about hair and makeup now, especially for Black women. And when I hear it, it's so horrible for me to remember that we had normalized that. We had normalized that you're a Black actress, you buy all your own makeup. White actors don't. You buy all your own hair products. You buy your own wigs. You buy your own. I used my wages to do things that the white actors didn't have to do. They just turned up with wet hair out of the shower and everybody did what they needed to do. I had to come prepared to do all my own stuff and be on set. And that was on a big show. So we're not talking about a little independent. That was what was just expected, that they did not provide things for Black actors in the way that they did for the white actors. So it's so sad to say. I mean, now we're bigger in numbers in the industry, but when we go back to what I'm talking about, there weren't enough of us to kick up the dust about it, only because we thought, you know, well, we're going to get fired. They're going to replace us. We were so scared about those things.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. You're in the middle of my conversation with Tanya Williams, the Canadian actor best known for her role as Dr. Olivia Barber Winters on the big hit running soap opera, The Young and the Restless. She was there for about two decades, and it was a role that changed Tanya's life. But this is really interesting. As you're about to hear, it changed the life of a lot of Black women in the U.S. that led to actual change in terms of Black women becoming doctors in the U.S. Here's more of our conversation. Let's talk about impact, though, that all that work you're talking to me about had. 2 years after you joined The Young and the Restless, you get an award from the Association of Black Physicians, and they tell you there was a 400% increase in Black women wanting to become physicians because of your role.
Yeah, that was a really meaningful award because I had no idea. You actually, you know, you're in front of the camera, you're doing what you're doing. I'm not really aware who's watching or what they're taking from what we're, you know, doing. But when they called me to say, we'd like to present you the award, and you're like, I'm getting an award from the Black Women Physicians of America. Like, I almost wanted to say, you guys don't think I'm a real doctor, do you? Like, I'm an actor playing a doctor. I thought for just a minute they were like, oh, we're giving you a great doctor award. I'm like, no. They went, no.
I just played one on TV.
But no, they were like, we've had a 400% increase of Black women signing up to be doctors. And when we're asking them why, they had seen you, that you were an impetus for that, which I had just absolutely no idea. And I think that was the beginning of me understanding the power of what we do. You're doing things, you're entertaining them, whatever. And then someone will come up to you. I'm sure, Tom, you've had this, and they've said something that you said on the radio.
Yeah.
It was totally impactful and changed the course of their life, of which you were just like, it did? Because that's not how you're thinking when you're doing it.
They normally just correct my grammar. No, I'm only joking. That is very true. You have no knowledge of the. You just think you're doing your job. I can hear what you're saying. You just thought you were doing your job. You know.
Yeah. So I really think that was a moment where I thought more of the power of our industry and thought more about who's in control of that power, you know, and how do the people, especially people of color, how do we get some of that power so that we can change the lives and help sort of educate society as a whole about people in general, but the larger population. I think it was kind of an epiphany for me, that particular thing. I mean, I thought of it in small ways, but no one had said something like that to me. 400% is like an insane amount to even think about.
I want to talk about what that led to in terms of the film festival. But first, I just want to talk just one more question about sort of the soap opera world, because it's not often I get to talk to somebody who spent that long on one of the biggest soap operas of all time. And this is going to sound silly, but I do mean it. What is soap opera fame like? Like, how does your life change when you get that role?
It is A-list actors, by the way, say it's different for them than even when they were on a soap opera. Because when you're on a soap opera, you're not like an actor anymore. You're not even like a big star or whatever. You are part of the family of the people who watch you. You are one of them. So when they see you anywhere, they feel like a part of, like they own you.
Like they'll just come up to and talk to you like your character, or they'll just like, oh, they'll talk really casually to you.
They totally talk to me like they, I don't feel they think it's a character, by the way. They say, how's your son doing? Now I have no children. So, or I love that you and Malcolm are together now.
Is this true, Tanya? Really?
And yeah, I'm not kidding. And they weren't saying it in a way like, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, you're on the show. They like believe it. They wondered, some of them, if I also had a medical practice. Like, you know, maybe acting was something I did on the side from my actual doctor work. And no matter how they would say, Olivia, I go, yeah, Tanya. They go, yeah. So Olivia, when you go
You wouldn't play along and go like, well, you know, yeah, I mean, it just came from the hospital or anything like that.
Yeah. No, after a while you just lean into it, because I would have a fear that if I died, my tombstone would say Olivia on it. Like, right. My real name was not valuable anymore. It's only Olivia was valuable. And that was really great because it serves a purpose and you have this audience but when you're trying to get out of it, you know how people sometimes ask the question, you know, are you able to separate yourself from your character?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And I would say, I totally separate myself from my character. Everyone else can't.
Clarity. It's like a reverse Daniel Day-Lewis method, you know?
And I knew that who I was always a disappointment to the fans, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
I could feel that because I am not like Olivia at all.
Yeah.
I'm just, you know, I'm like a schlep. I'm like, roll out. I go around looking like, you know, whatever, my sweatpants on or whatever. And I could tell in their eyes because they'd go, are you?
I'm glad they weren't coming to you with broken bones or anything like that, though.
I have had people talk to me about their medical things.
No.
Like serious stuff.
No.
Yeah. And I would go, you know, whatever your doctor says, I'm just like, in what reality would you tell me these really personal details about your medical stuff that I don't know what I would do with that, you know? No, they do it. And they're serious, and it's not even to make fun of them. In fact, it helps us. Here's where it helps us, Tom. It helps us understand politics today. Because you and I are on the other side of this curtain going, why would people believe that? And now I totally understand. From having my lived experience in soap operas, I understand things that we can't understand why an audience would believe that politician or would believe. They believe in these things in a way that it's not like how we who work in the industry see it, where, oh, it's just a piece of entertainment. It is truth for them. And that's why I get scared sometimes when we're not always being as responsible as we should be in the content we make. And we like to think, oh, what we're making is not affecting young people or whatever. It is seriously affecting young people. And especially because we've just finished a research report through Real World, actually, around the depiction of women of color on Canadian screens. And it's amazing the percentage of violence that we perpetuate in our industry around women. And how we don't think that transcends to the increased violence of women on the other side of the screen. That we need to be thinking about these things. And that's why stereotypes can be so dangerous. We're perpetuating things that make people fearful.
This first part of my conversation with the Canadian groundbreaking actor Tanya Williams. Coming up, we'll talk about the Real World Film Festival she founded, which was this festival that celebrated and advocated for diversity in filmmaking and in film festivals long before it became like a hallmark of every film festival's mandate. The Real World gives a platform and opportunities to marginalized Canadians. Plus, her surprise answer to whether or not she ever tried on the Pokeroo costume. I'm Tom Power. More Q after this.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
It's like being in high school and having homework every single night. It's not parties and red carpets and hanging out. It's like, I don't know where that is.
I feel your pain, Tanya Williams. I'm Tom Power. You are listening to Q. You're in the middle of my conversation with the Canadian actor Tanya Williams, who came to a really specific style of work, as you just heard her talk about, and a really specific style of fame, playing Dr. Olivia Winters on the big hit soap opera, The Young and the Restless. This year, Tanya is receiving the Changemaker Award from the Canadian Screen Awards, an award given annually to someone who over their career has used their voice and platform to call out systemic racism and discrimination. And that leads us to Tanya's work in the early 2000s, where Tanya started the Real World Film Festival in Toronto, which is a festival that's still screens films, provides professional development for racialized Canadians. This was decades she started this before film festivals and major arts organizations started making diversity a priority. So it was this festival, though, that would give Tanya the push, or I guess the fork in the road, to make a choice between this festival and her advocacy work and The Young and the Restless. Here's more of our conversation.
What were those early days getting the festival off the ground like? Doing this in 2000 is a lot different than doing this in the past, like, 2 or 3 or 4 years.
Oh, my God. First of all, there was only film. film. Big casts.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So let's just even start, you know, from there. Now we shoot an email with the whole film on it.
Yeah.
It was hard. And I was always doing this remotely. So there wasn't Zoom. There was barely, I think it was still dial-up internet back in those days.
Yeah.
So things were definitely harder. I was flying back and forth like a great deal. I was stressing myself out, but I wasn't, I just love taking on projects that are just hard, but I like feeling my way through something and figuring it out. And here's something that people don't often hear. I don't feel as brave as some people think that when I do things, because the expectation when you look at someone like me, like a Black woman, the world's expectation of me is so low that I actually feel incredible freedom to fail, because that is the expectation. Mm. So I actually think there are people where it's more stressful for them, because the world has said you are the poster child for what success should look like. So if you don't step up to that, you're a failure. Mm. I, on the other hand, people were always shocked and surprised at sort of anything I did. So when I started something like this, they were like, oh, this is, you know, a vanity project. You know how those actors are. They're always coming up with a vanity project. So I let them say whatever they want to say. I just kept moving forward. As I told you, I just listen to people saying things. I just keep moving forward. You know, I created a business knowing nothing about creating a business. And then I made every mistake possible, because that's how I like to learn. And I started to build the foundation of this thing. But by 5 years in, it was taking up now 100% of my time, and I was still on the show. And I felt something's going to break. Like, I am going to break. This is not sustainable. And so I went into a deep kind of, you know, thought about the whole thing and processed what I wanted my life to be. And I realized I totally loved doing YNR, but I did not see myself as someone who would want to be on the show for 40 years. Mm. Whereas changing policy and, you know, changing the mindset of the world and doing those, that is something I could see myself long-term really feeling excited about for a really long period of time. And so I left the show, I was shocked how many people were shocked I left. Almost like they couldn't process it.
Well, like you said, you're like a member of their family.
I'm a member of their family. But I mean, people in the industry, it was like, it was like I was supposed to stay on this path forever.
Right.
And if you come off the path, what is wrong with you?
Right.
You know, something, you're on a successful show, you're making this good money, you're making, it was hard for people to understand. And I think even today, 20 years later, I think it's still challenging for people to understand the choices I make. But I can only make the choices I make that I know are right for me. I don't know if it was right for anybody else. But Real World was something that was, it was a kernel of something that was inside of me that needed to grow and needed to expand. Because I love helping people. I mean, I just do. And I was instilled in that just from my parents who loved helping people.
Well, let's stay on that for a second, because that was the mm-hmm. that was the next question I had, is that, you know, at the very beginning, I asked you, you know, where did this firstness come from in you? And you talked, you know, hey, Tom, you know, it was up to me. I wouldn't have been first. But, you know, my parents had this incredible life. And, you know, and I wanted to live up to the example they set for me. And, you know, they were really inspiring to me. But you could have stopped there. And what I find interesting about you, and especially in terms of you getting this Changemaker Award, is that it's about helping other people. Like, a lot, you don't really necessarily have to use your platform to help others. I mean, we are called to, but you don't have to do it. But you do.
Yeah, but it just feels really, I don't know. It was instilled in me because my father, even though he was this lawyer, his practice was immediately going to England and being a lawyer. His number one thing was to go back to Jamaica and start his practice. And it was all people who were poorer people, people who did not have a voice, people who what. So that was how he focused. Even towards the end of his life, when he retired as a lawyer, he ended up becoming one of the justices for what happened in Rwanda and the tribunals that happened. That was just built in. Doing something for your community was always the way it was. My mother, becoming a registered nurse, she could have gone to a lot of different places, but she went back, you know, when she and my father went back to Jamaica, she found jobs that took her into the poorest areas of Jamaica to help them understand about healthcare. She would take me to these neighborhoods and I pulled off my shoes and socks and ran around in the dirt. And it was like normal to me to be in these different atmospheres. And I could see that my life was an easier life. And so and then when I became an actor and I found success as an actor, it just tortures me to see someone wanting to be an actor or wanting to be in this business, but they are not finding their way in. And I am determined to find them a way in. And even I would rather they just got in and then went, oh, you know what? This is actually not my journey. And I actually hate this.
Yeah.
But to see someone scratching on the door or peering through the window
and not being allowed in and not being allowed
and not being allowed in, and you're inside. I cannot look out there and see them standing there and not want to open that door and say, come inside.
Oh my.
You actually think this is a great party, but it's horrible. But you need to come in. You know, even if you just come in and go, oh, this is all it is.
It's still better than being out in the rain.
It's still better than you out there because you have a fantasy that something in here. And even now, I spend a lot of my time explaining my life to people because they have an illusion and a fantasy of what my life is like. You know what acting is like, feels for me? It's like being in high school and having homework every single night.
Yeah.
It's not parties and red carpets and hanging out. It's like, I don't know where that is.
But what's meaningful there is that you've, I don't know. I'm so moved by that story that you told me about your mom and your dad and then how you sort of applied it to your own life to try and help others. I mean, if you can tell from this conversation already, what a meaningful award and what an appropriate award this is for you to get. I don't know what to say to you. Congratulations again on it.
Oh, thank you. But, no, it really is wonderful.
But before we go, I have one more question. Did you ever wear the Pokeroo outfit?
No, you know what? First of all, I never thought about it, but I've only thought about it now as you said it.
You never got to try on the Pokeroo costume?
Worse than that, Tom, I didn't even think about asking. You have just realized I could have at least, can I just try it on?
Yeah.
But I didn't think of it. I didn't even think of it.
I don't think it's too late.
I don't know. I put some weight on. So I have a feeling I'm bigger than Pokeroo now.
Everybody here at Q, our deepest congratulations and so well deserved this award. And thank you so much for making the time for us today.
Oh, thank you. And I really hope people tune in for the Canadian Screen Awards because it's going to be an amazing show.
The polka dot door, the polka dot door. Let's peek through the polka dot door.
Tanya Williams was my guest. I'm just saying to the Canadian Screen Awards people, what a great surprise it would be if Pokeroo showed up. Tanya Williams will be honored with the Changemaker Award at the Canadian Screen Awards on May 30th. But then again, if Pokeroo showed up, would anyone see him? That's it for the show today. Tomorrow on the show, this is very exciting. We've been sitting on this for a couple of days now. Excited for you to hear it. Noah Kahn, who just sold out 3 nights at the Scotiabank Center in Toronto. That's about 60,000 tickets. We'll be here for a Canadian exclusive interview about finding himself at home with his parents during the pandemic and writing songs for the first time that felt authentic to him and what it has led to. A very revealing and powerful conversation with Noah Kahn tomorrow on the show. We'll see you soon. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.